Why am I choosing to write about this multi-front assault on our society, culture, families, and very way of life? Because I see it. I know where it is headed, and I refuse to choose to accept it. The 10 working principles for a healthy society. How to push back against the social media platforms. How to get your family strong again. You can get it anywhere books are sold on February 27th. I'm really excited today to have Michael Schellenberger. He's been on Dr. Phil, and we were talking about harm reduction, which is a philosophy that believes to avoid deaths from overdoses, that strategies should be implemented to allow drug addicts access to various drugs in a presumably safe way. I'm not so sure that's a really good idea. I don't think Michael does either. Also under the philosophy, it believes that addicts should be allowed resources, housing, et cetera, without questions asked about one's sobriety. Now, Michael says that his book, San Francisco, Why Progressives Ruin Cities, examines the way harm reduction policies have emphasized personal liberties but ignore personal responsibilities. Anybody that's been to San Francisco in years past have always thought it was one of the most beautiful cities in the world, one of the most picturesque cities in the world, sitting on the bay there. And there are still parts of San Francisco that are beautiful. I'm sure you would agree.
Oh, it's still my favorite city in the world. I moved out here after college because I am in love with the city, and its essence is still there. It's just a very tarnished jewel at this point.
Talk about that just in general. What has happened? And why is it so tarnished? Because this has to have been philosophical and systemic from top to bottom and side to side for a city to get in this much trouble in this short a period of time.
Sure. Well, so San Francisco, it's a very progressive city. It's a city that loves freedom. It's obviously, or maybe not obviously, but I think many people know it's the home to the gay and lesbian movement, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender movements. It's been a place of free spirits. It's very libertarian. It's also very compassionate. It's named after St. Francis, of course, who was the saint of compassion and taking care of the poor and of nature. And the combination of those two things, those two strengths in excess, leads to pathology. And so what's occurred is the coddling of people that are struggling with drug addiction, where they need tough love, they're basically being enabled in their addiction. And so the city is it's overly generous in the sense of basically providing cash, housing, and many other services to people without any requirement that they address the underlying cause of their homelessness. You know, over 20,000 people come to San Francisco every year as homeless individuals. The vast majority of them struggling with drug addiction and or untreated mental illness. There's ostensibly about 8,000 homeless people in the city at any given time, half of whom are on the streets. And so we've seen a threefold higher overdose rate in San Francisco from drugs, threefold higher than in the United States as a whole or in California. And that's all a consequence of the refusal of San Francisco's leaders to require people to take responsibility for their behaviors, including not defecating in public, not using drugs in public, not camping in public. And many basic laws have stopped being enforced. And so that's what's the fundamental dynamic that's led to the destruction of the city.
Look, go back to Psychology 101. One of the things that we know is you just don't reward bad behavior. Go back to Skinner, go back to the most fundamental behaviorist, whether you're in a rat lab, whether you're dealing with animals, whether you're dealing with humans, the behavior you want to see repeated, you reinforce. The behavior you want to see extinguished, you either punish or withhold reinforcement. Seriously, the first week of Psychology 101, that's one of the principles that you learn, and it holds true across species, across ages within the human race, but it seems like this has been forgotten because it appears that there are certain parts within the political spectrum that believe that if you reinforce certain behaviors, that somehow they will miraculously feel a bond of brotherhood and will just stop their self-destructive behaviors. I don't get it. I'm confused. I don't understand how that is supposed to work. But what you're describing to me sounds like enabling in its most fundamental form. And enabling, that term gets used so much, I think it loses its meaning. It means making it easier or paving the way for someone to continue to do self-destructive behaviors, either giving them money for drugs, giving them housing, protecting them from prosecution, doing anything that you do that makes it possible for them to continue to do what they're doing.
That's right. In fact, it's, you may be interested to know, or you may remember from San Francisco, that the turn against having consequences for destructive behaviors, including self-destructive behaviors, the argument against that came from a psychologist, a radical left psychologist in the late 60s, who wrote a very famous book called Blaming the Victim. And what he argued was that simply enforcing laws in many cases, or requiring, or having a work requirement for welfare, or other responsibilities imposed, required of groups that had been historically discriminated against, was unjust. And that's where it comes from. And so it starts with, basically, basically incentivizing people not to work with welfare. That was obviously changed decades later. But the argument in defense of that policy was that it was kind of making amends for the injustices that were done to African Americans for centuries in the United States. And it's very powerful because all of us, I think, most people do feel bad about the history of the United States towards African Americans, and we feel guilty. And I think that that guilt is very easy to manipulate and make people feel guilty if they then are asking for, say, equal justice under the law. It then goes further and gets what gets added on to that white guilt is, I think, the pleasure of caring. And I think we tend to think of caring for others as a selfless act, but we know that we feel good caring, and that's really great. We should feel good caring for others. But I think we've all seen in our own lives, certainly I've seen it depicted on Hollywood movies, most famously Misery with Kathy Bates, adapted from the Stephen King novel, where people can be pathological in their desire to care so much that they actually end up hurting people, either in order to care or to be able to keep caring. And so I think that there's some self-indulgence here, in addition to the guilt, which is, I think, San Franciscans, we feel, it's a very wealthy city, it's a very liberal city, it's powerful people. They had a very good record during the AIDS epidemic in the 80s in particular, of welcoming people with HIV/AIDS from around the country into San Francisco and treating them. And it was an incredibly positive contribution. And I think that, when that bled into then taking care of addicts, what got missed or what was run over in this desire to care was the fact that enabling addiction worsens the addiction. It actually makes people sicker than they would be otherwise.
Well, I don't see that there's any other possible outcome. Clearly, you have to have empathy. Clearly, you have to have compassion. But I've worked a lot with rehabilitation, and I'm not talking about drug rehabilitation. I'm talking about those that have suffered closed head injuries or just physical injuries on the job or car accidents or whatever. And one of the things that we have learned in working with quadriplegics, paraplegics, or those with just severe injuries that have to re-educate their body is that in order to get better, you absolutely must require the patient to do 100% of what they're capable of doing at every step of the process, or they never get to the next level. So if a paraplegic can get 8 or 9 feet across the room to flip a light switch themselves, and you could go over and do it for them and just let them sit there, it would be much easier. And you think, oh, they're so tired, I want to do this for them. But if you do that, you cheat them out of two things. Number one, you cheat them out of going through the muscle movements and creating the muscle memories of doing that. And number two, you cheat them out of the opportunity to observe themselves mastering that and increasing their self-worth and self-esteem because they saw themselves do it. It seems to me that what's happening here, when we don't require these drug addicts or these people that are living a compromised life to do everything they possibly can do to get back to becoming a contributing member of society each and every day, we're cheating them out of both of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of my favorite examples from nature is if you try to help a baby chick to get out of the egg, then the baby chick will die because the chick doesn't have a chance to build up the neck muscles that are built up while cracking the egg. We see that in the case of homelessness in San Francisco. We used to require that people not camp in tents on the sidewalk and sleep in the shelter. Well, the demand from radical progressives was that people should be allowed to sleep on the sidewalk. We used to say you can't be drunk or intoxicated in public. We then say it's okay. We used to say you can't shoot drugs in public. Then they say, well, it's okay. You know, when my first research foray on with a homeless service provider, the provider was telling me quite proudly that they had done research with the homeless that they were working with. And what the homeless told them is that they wanted the service providers to bring food and clothing to them. They didn't want to have to go to a service center. They didn't want to have to walk a few blocks away. They wanted these things brought to their tents. So you get a very dystopian perspective. This culminates in COVID, where you basically have the city turning over a very large parking area in front of the San Francisco City Hall and the library with people in tents who would only get out occasionally to shower, but they would also have food brought to them. And they would basically only get up to get their drugs and go back to the tents. And so you're basically creating atrophy. You're creating addicts who are becoming atrophied vegetables because of their chronic methamphetamine and fentanyl use. In particular, the two drugs have swamped most of the other drugs and are often being used in combination. So yeah, it's exactly what you described, Dr. Phil. It's been a gradual process. You can sort of trace it, as I've done in San Francisco, over the decades. But ultimately, you get to a place where basically we've turned people that would otherwise be normally functioning adults into babies.
The first page of a book never tells the full story. And those news alerts and headlines, like the ones we get on our phones, don't even scratch the surface of what the story is really all about. Stories are like people, multi-layered and complex. It takes some digging to find the truth, but when we find it, it can change our world. We like to dig. The news on Merritt Street. Essential television.
Lauren, we are sisters.
That's true.
And we host a celebrity-obsessed podcast called Pop Apologists.
We also love Taylor Swift. Chandler, how are you managing to cope while we await Taylor's new album?
Look, I want to be put into a medically induced coma and wake up on April 19th, but I'm not sure my insurance is going to cover it.
Join us on our pop culture podcast, Pop Apologists, where we will be dishing on all things celebrity news and deep diving every word and note of Taylor's new album.
Pop Apologists.
Pop Apologists.
Wendy Murphy is an attorney that specializes in the representation of crime victims, particularly women and children. For more than 15 years, Wendy has served as an adjunct professor of sexual violence law at New England Law, Boston. She also co-directs the Women's and Children's Advocacy Project under the Center for Law and Social Responsibility. She's done so much. I could go on forever and not even get to her. There are a lot of people, men and women, but women that get victimized by it, are not aware that women do not have equal protection under the law. they don't have it constitutionally, and they don't have it pragmatically. And you don't realize that until you wind up in the court system, and there's somebody up there saying, HIPAA be damned, confidentiality be damned, and all of the rules of evidence that apply in other crimes all of a sudden are thrown out the window.
Right.
And all of these things that you can't bring up in a robbery case or you can't bring up in a murder case about pre-offense information that never gets in front of a jury, all of a sudden is paraded out in front of the jury about a victim that has been brutally raped. They can now talk about what she did in high school, what she did in college, what she did at a party 3 weeks before this happened. And you're sitting there saying, wait a minute, this predated the offense. What the hell does this have to do with what happened that night?
Yep.
But yet it's admitted and it's not reversed on appeal when it is clear violation of the rules of evidence. So yep. It doesn't happen just at the trial level. It's upheld at the appellate level.
Yeah, exactly right. So when I've argued countless appeals in these cases, and I've made this point that you cannot treat these types of victims differently. It's just a violation of equal protection of law. And I make all these arguments that are about the Constitution being designed to protect everybody equally and give everybody equal rights. And generally speaking, the courts say back to me, but you're wrong, Ms. Murphy. Women aren't entitled to equal treatment and equal protection of law under the Constitution. You need to fix the 14th Amendment and then come back and make that argument to us. And boy, is that a hard pill to swallow, to, you know, be in a court of law where there's some sign on the wall that says equal justice under law. And you know, that's just not right. I'll give you a couple of good examples that apply specifically to therapy records that were devastating in cases. And this continues to happen today. One, I was representing a woman who'd been nearly killed by a man who had also brutally raped and killed other women. And she was brave enough to testify against him, and he demanded access to her counseling records that predated this man's brutal assault of her. We fought like hell to stop those records from being turned over, because when she had therapy, she was told by her therapist that was a private session, that what she was saying was confidential, and she needed that promise of confidentiality in order to be open about her feelings and to get better. But the judge basically, and when I challenged the judge who ordered the records turned over, I said, what does this have to do with anything about what happened the night he beat her? You know, why aren't you ordering her to turn over her grocery receipts if you don't care about relevancy, right? The judge slammed his gavel and said, Ms. Murphy, if you keep talking, I'm going to dismiss the charges and this man will walk free. That's what it came to. So my client starts sobbing. She begged me to give him anything he wants. If this man gets out of jail, he's going to kill me. Please just give him my counseling records. So we did. In the records, there was a description of her being sexually abused by her dad when she was a little girl. No one knew about it. Her family didn't know. And of course, what did that man use as evidence during the trial? That she had been sexually abused by her father, and she was now falsely accusing him in order to avenge her childhood experience. That, you know, she ended up winning the case, but what a price to pay that had to be revealed to the whole world, because the news was covering the case. Her family found out. Everyone learned something that should have been confidential, had nothing to do with the case, was deeply personal to her. And that's a price for justice that we only impose on women, and it's outrageous.
Well, it is outrageous, and it is a clear violation of the rules of evidence and what is admissible. And so they just, at that point, ignore the rules of evidence and say, we're going to suspend those because this is a woman.
Yep.
I'm not a lawyer, but the rules of evidence are very clear. And so a judge has to just say, I'm going to ignore this rule of evidence and admit this and let the jury see it, let the press in the room see it. And I don't understand how a sitting judge can ignore the rules of an evidence because of the sex of a victim. It's mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling. It's also, in my opinion, unconstitutional. But when push comes to shove and I make the constitutional argument before appellate courts, they remind me that women are not yet equal under the Constitution. We are not yet entitled to equal treatment or equal protection of law. And what that means, and it's very obvious, you see it statistically in the high rates of abuse of women in this country. What that means is when you call the police or report an incident of violence against women to prosecutors and they decline charges or file charges and have the rules of evidence not work fairly, there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, that's really the bottom line here. There's nothing you can do about it. And I like to point out to people that, you know, here's equal protection of law. Here's unequal protection of law. Here's where women are. That space in the middle is where rape and domestic violence and abuse happens with impunity under the law, because this is equal treatment and this is where women are. And everything in the middle is where violence happens with impunity. And there's nothing you can do about it, constitutionally or otherwise. You can't complain about it, because if you complain about it, the courts are going to say, we're sorry, but you're going to have to fix the Constitution and come back to us later.
People ask me sometimes, you know, Dr. Phil, you often say that rape is one of the most underreported crimes in the country, because I've said, you know, 1 in 4 women are the victim of sexual violence. And at that, it's underreported. Why? These are the reasons why. What we've been talking about is the fact that they are subjected to these pre-offense audits of their life, and everything in the world is pulled out. Like you said, a woman had to out the fact that things had happened to her with her father before, where she had been raped by him. Then I've seen cases where they then take that and pull out research that says when that happens to a child, they often become promiscuous. And then because of the promiscuity, they wanted this. They use it to spin it against them psychologically. They go into their dating histories and put them on trial. All of these things are underreported, and that's why a lot of them don't come forward and bring charges against the person.
You know, rape is very underreported, always has been. And that's partly because we do make it painful to seek justice. Justice should not be painful. We should be celebrating people who are reporting crimes, whether it's a drunk driver, a bank robber, or violence behind closed doors. It's all violence against society. It's all crime against society. And it's not a private problem just because it happens behind closed doors. I think we forget that sometimes. So we need to reward people who come forward, treat them as heroic. Because when people speak, when they talk about crimes that happen, no matter where they happen, it helps prevent crimes against others. That's one of the benefits of the criminal justice system. It deters other people from doing the same things. So if you keep pushing victims away of certain types of crimes, if you keep messaging them that it's going to be painful for them to participate in the legal system, you're basically telling others in society, don't bother. Don't bother, because, you know, it's not worth it. On the other hand, look how we treat people who witness arsons and bank robberies and drunk driving. Boy, they're up on a pedestal and we can't do enough for them, and we don't ask them about their mental health backgrounds. You can literally be an eyewitness to a drunk driving with a long mental health history that may well affect your credibility. Nobody asks. Nobody asks, because we want those people to come forward. We want to celebrate them as heroes in society for reporting violence. We really need to bring that philosophy to bear on all forms of violence, including crimes that happened in the family, behind closed doors. Every crime that happens, no matter where, is a public injury. It hurts all of us. And we don't think that way when it comes to violence against women. And that's one of the reasons we don't really get as upset as we should about the fact that so many victims don't come forward. You just don't see the outrage about the lack of reporting. In fact, if anything, you'll even see from advocacy groups, which makes me crazy, they'll say, oh, you know, we have to respect the fact that this rape victim doesn't want to come forward, doesn't want to testify. We have to protect the victims from the trauma of the system. That's crap, if you ask me. That is insanity, because it's like indulging a terrorist. Well, the system is so terrible, let's just not bother with justice. No, stand up, fight, demand justice, kick back. If you're mistreated, make a stink about it. That's how change happens. You have to participate and complain to make reforms real. Just saying, I'm not going to call the police or I'm not going to report my domestic violence case because I'm worried the system isn't going to treat me with respect, you're just rewarding the bad system. Not to mention, you're going to get beaten again and again and again, and it's going to escalate. And other women are going to see that that you're doing that, and so they're not going to call, and so on and so on. This is how we create a culture of tolerance for violence against women. And, you know, it's not easy for me to say to my clients, you should testify, because they think I know better than them. That's not my meaning. When I try to encourage them to testify, it's because I don't like rewarding the systemic injustices. It's just not fair to my clients or to women as a class.
On Oops the Podcast, join me, comedian Giulio Gallerati, as I examine everyday life, the mistakes, the bad decisions, the goals, the jokes, the social engagements, and all things in between. I'm joined every week by producer and personal confidant Ryan Lynch, various other comedians, for witty, candid, and intoxicating conversation. Our listeners love Oops for sophisticated banter, aka your mom could listen, and many feel like they're in the room with us chopping it up with old pals. You can find every episode of the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube.
We've all seen the headlines in the news of how someone lost their life in an act of cold-blooded murder. And while it's sad and grabs your attention, most people go on with their day without giving it another thought. But have you ever stopped to think about the life of the person at the center of the news story? They were more than just a headline or a statistic. They were someone's loved one or friend. I'm Mike Morford, and my podcast, The Murder of My Family, dives into some of those stories to help listeners get to know the person who was lost and how their death affected those closest to them. Listen to The Murder of My Family everywhere you listen to podcasts. There are well over 100 episodes to binge on now.
Well, undoubtedly what you're saying is true. You don't reward bad behavior and you have to push back. The problem is, and I got to put my shrink hat on here for a minute, we find victims all up and down the psychological continuum. And some of these victims are truly psychologically damaged before, by, and after what has happened to them. They just simply don't have the psychological wherewithal. They don't have the stamina. They don't have the emotional resources. They don't have the support system to endure the onslaught. And when they get held up to ridicule, like the client you talked about that ultimately won, but the family was dragged into all of this disclosure and all. There are some people that are severely depressed. They maybe have suicidal ideation. They may be on the brink of psychosis, or they may have issues that when you add the burden of all of this on top of it, they just simply don't have the mental emotional resources to carry that burden so they can take one for the team, but you lose them in the process. They either become so broken, withdrawn, commit suicide, check out in different ways, and not everybody can do it. I've had many a patient when I was in private practice in the situation where I knew very damn well they couldn't do it. Yeah. They weren't the one to charge up that hill and fight that battle because they would never make it to the top.
It's a really important point, Dr. Phil, and let me clarify what I was talking about, because I would never, ever force someone to testify if it was going to hurt them. I would never do that. But here's what I want people to know. The system that indulges the idea cavalierly that it's too stressful to testify and just does it across the board, just lets women drop the charges. or not testify because they don't feel like it or they're scared. The problem with that approach is that you're teaching the offender to threaten, intimidate, you know, bribe the witnesses. And you're really giving complete control over the criminal justice system to the bad guys. That's number one. And that's a really important thing to remember. So my policy approach is not to always force victims to testify, but to have all prosecutors' offices have as a policy a presumption that the case will go forward and that the victim will be expected to testify, because this is to message the bad guy, don't bother trying to threaten her, intimidate her, harass her into not testifying. You're not going to get anywhere. It's just not going to work, and we're not going to indulge you. There's actually some research from California that shows the benefits of my policy, my approach. I didn't come up with this idea. This is research from many years ago. In year zero, there were something like 50 domestic violence homicides. And that year, they adopted a policy, which is called a no-drop rule, that once a domestic violence case is reported, it has to go through and the victim has to testify, no exceptions. They did this for 5 years. And at the end of the study, the domestic violence homicide rate went down to single digits. And that only policy change they made was that no drop rule. So they know that that was the reason women's lives were saved. Now, were some women forced to testify? A couple. Was it stressful? Absolutely. Was it worth it? A lot of lives were saved. Now, I still think if a woman can't testify because it's too psychologically overwhelming, you have to respect that. But if the reason she's not testifying is because she has no resources, she doesn't know where she's going to live, she has no money, she's afraid she's going to lose custody of her children, then my solution is don't indulge her fears. Give her a place to live. Give her free counseling. Give her the tools and the things that she needs to be able to become a strong person. Don't just say it's okay that you're so traumatized and suffering. We're going to leave you be. Take advantage of the opportunity to give her what she needs to become strong and hold the charges open until she is strong enough. Reward her. Reward her. We have to turn this into a system of rewards.
Yeah, that's an alternative if they can fund that, but that takes a lot of money and a lot of time, and that may drop to single digits, but you got to wonder how many cases weren't brought because the woman said, no, I won't testify, so don't bring the case. It may have dropped to single digits for the ones that were actually brought, but you wonder how many said, no, I won't because I can't. But you did what you're saying where you said, look, we will support you. We will protect you. We will get you to the point where you're okay to do this before we ask you to do it, then you've got a different situation. Dr. Phil here. Come February 27th, you're going to be able to pick up a book called We've Got Issues, and you know we do. This is a book that says it's going to teach you how to stand strong for America's soul and sanity. And in this book, I set forth 10 principles for saving this society from going off the deep end. 10 principles for protecting your family. 10 principles for giving you what you need to flourish and have the life that you want for yourself and for your children and for your grandchildren. We've taken some wrong turns. We've been letting the loudest voices dictate some of the thinking that has taken us way off course. Well, I'm speaking up and bringing us back to the center of the road. I hope you'll pick this book up, and I hope you'll read it with a real open mind, because I'm pushing back against a lot of what you've been hearing. Somebody had to do it. Might as well be me. February 27th, We've Got Issues. Justin Paperny is the co-founder of White Collar Advice. He wrote a book called Lessons from Prison, and there's a lot of insight there. Your background and who you are, you're a felon and an ex-con.
Yes.
You got sentenced to the federal penitentiary for white-collar crime, and it had to do with conspiracy to commit fraud with regard to securities, correct?
I was a stockbroker at Bear Stearns, then UBS, and several years into my career, despite all the success I had had, I found myself making some bad decisions on behalf of a client. As a result of those poor choices, I was inevitably sentenced to 18 months in federal prison.
I don't want to get into the specifics of your crime because, frankly, people don't care. What they do care about is you got caught, and now you're quick to say that you were wrong. You were guilty, correct?
Indeed. One of my biggest regrets is not accepting responsibility sooner. And as a result of my not accepting responsibility sooner, I made it harder on victims, those that love and support me. So that was my biggest regret amongst a long list of regrets.
When you first got charged, you were in denial at the same time, correct?
When I learned that I was in trouble, I said, this is not a big deal. They're going to see that I didn't have bad intent, that I was clearly swept into this. And they're going to see that I'm a student athlete from USC, and I had hundreds of clients who loved me, and I never had a problem before. So as a result of that flawed thinking and spinning lies to lawyers, then later lying to the FBI because I did not want them to perceive me as a criminal, I had lied and made matters measurably worse. So denial took years off of my life and led to a longer prison sentence.
I want to break that down a little bit. So you got charged, and at the time, had you admitted to yourself that you had done wrong, or were you deluding yourself?
I was deluding myself. In fact, I've trained new agents at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, and when the FBI agent that arrested me introduced me to the agents, he said, before I spoke, had Justin been honest with us when we interviewed him, we would not have pursued prosecution. Think about how different my life is as a result of my unwillingness to accept responsibility in front of two FBI agents because of shame, denial, living like the ostrich with my head buried. So yes, my life is forever changed because I couldn't step up and say, I made some bad decisions and I regret them.
So he said if you had been honest, they wouldn't have prosecuted you?
Think about that. I talk a lot about post-defense conduct in this Varsity Blues college cheating case. We've got to pay attention to post-defense conduct. What defendants are doing between indictment and a potential trial or sentencing hearing. It is a big deal, the record they need to begin to create as a law-abiding citizen, because the government is judging them for some bad decisions they made. They've got to work to change that narrative. I did that terribly as a defendant. They have an opportunity to do better.
But at the time you were sitting in front of the FBI agent, you weren't just lying to him. You were lying to yourself.
And to my lawyers, flushing money down the toilet. I was a lawyer's dream client, potentially.
You said you spent $50,000.
$50,000 just to get in the door and sign a retainer for a white-collar defense attorney. I blew through $50,000.
Lying.
Lying immediately. I didn't want to own and acknowledge my criminal conduct. As I wrote in Lessons from Prison, I needed someone like me to drop a bucket of cold ice on my head and maybe throw a right punch and say, get it together, bud. I didn't have that.
You said that you then got a criminal lawyer.
I did.
You were talking about taking a polygraph, and this lawyer said, look, do not lie. You cannot beat this polygraph. Do not kid yourself. Do not go in there and try to lie. And you studied countermeasures.
Not only before I studied countermeasures, I told my lawyer, I said, I'm insulted. I'm innocent. I've done nothing wrong. I'm being swept into this. I'm insulted that you actually would suggest that I would cheat this exam. This is how little you think of me as a client of yours. He said, Justin, please, you're very smart, but you can make some dumb decisions. Do not cheat the exam. So, of course, once I left his office.
You then went to the internet, started downloading.
I still have the receipt, Dr. Phil. $350. I bought a lie detector test, and I studied very aggressively for several days, studying to beat that exam and mastering all of the techniques.
All the countermeasures, everything from attacking the shoe to tightening your muscles and
The tush.
Everything. And you got in there and failed miserably.
The lie detector test is presided by a former FBI agent. I did it at the office in San Francisco. And I sat for the test and I squeezed my innards when appropriate, pinched the toe when I was supposed to. And I thought, I have this. Like, I'll be back on the golf course in 2 days. This is great. Then the results came back and my lawyer asked the FBI agent to leave. And then they said with greater than 99.99% I had failed the exam. Okay. And I remember looking out into Alcatraz from the San Francisco office thinking, this is not good.
You said, and I quote from your book, your lawyer said, Justin, you're going to prison. It's time to wrap your mind around that reality. You're on incredibly weak ground here. The government prosecutors are prepared to charge you with numerous felonies, including now obstruction of justice.
Yes.
Did it hit you then?
Embarrassingly, no. What I did do was say, do whatever you have to do to ensure I get the best possible outcome. Yeah. Whatever I have to say to try to avoid a lengthy prison term because my lawyers told me that you're going to get 5 years in prison without question. I remember saying, how could I get 5 or 6 or 7 years? I was swept into this. I didn't understand that whether you had intent or not, how you respond to trouble plays a significant role in your outcome.
They said, you need to trust us to protect your interests because you're not. When it finally hits you that you suddenly realized how suicide seemed like a viable option for so many people, you could see how you felt trapped.
When I was staring out to Alcatraz prison after failing that lie detector test, I understood how suicide could be a viable option. I couldn't envision one day in prison, let alone 5 years.
You came to terms with that. At some point, you did make a plea, right?
I did. I pled guilty to one count of conspiracy.
When you did that, when you made the plea, you had to spell out certain things, right?
I had to own and acknowledge my conduct in front of Judge Wilson.
Right. Did that feel like an unburdening to you, or did that feel like a low point for you?
The unburdening for me came after I was sentenced because I had some clarity. I had a clearly defined prison term and a clearly defined release date. The hardest part for me and for many of our clients at White Collar Advice is the guilty plea, because you're standing in front of an open court acknowledging your criminal conduct. Then, of course, the flood of press releases come, the embarrassment and shame to your family, and the fallout really begins at the guilty plea. By sentencing, in many ways, you're so numb to all of the fallout that you're desensitized to it. The guilty plea was the hardest part for me.
Once you made the plea and you knew, you got 18 months and you served how many?
I served a little more than 15 months total, a little more than 12 months in prison.
And three was in a halfway house, right?
Yes, in Hollywood.
Okay. You suspect that your mindset when you were in denial, telling yourself, this just is not part of my life. I'm not destined to go to prison. This was not in your cards.
Denial makes you feel better. It provides some moments of solace, but longer term, it's a recipe for disaster. And I didn't recognize that at the time. It's okay, it's denial, go down this road, I didn't do it. And it felt good. But as I just mentioned, it was longer term. It ended up horrifically.
Let me ask you this. Should you have gone to prison?
Yes.
Why? It was a nonviolent crime. You didn't hit anybody. You didn't kill anybody. You didn't maim anybody.
I was raised with opportunity and a lot of privilege, something I told the judge. I was raised by parents that work hard and taught me right from wrong. I played baseball at USC, and my coaches held me accountable. When I worked my way into my career of money management, I began to descend to the lowest levels of beginning to admire and associate with men who were unethical, dishonest, yet they made the most money. They had the country clubs, the Rolexes, the cars, the homes, and I didn't pay attention to imbalances in their personal life. So by virtue of associating with some people, I very easily succumbed to bad behaviors. I stopped pursuing values. And as a result of that, when I faced a decision that should have been very clear, a decision that I clearly knew was wrong, I didn't stop to think. I easily gave in to temptation, and while no one might have been killed or died, people were hurt, and there should be consequences that come with breaking the law. I had a Series 7. I had a degree from USC. I had several $100 million under management. As Judge Wilson said at my sentencing, people need to know what happened when you turn the other way for money. Most don't get caught. You did. I'm sending you to prison. So it makes an example, and it works as a deterrent for others.
My experience is, I always say the best predictor of future behavior is relevant past behavior.
Yes.
So the best predictor of whether a prospective employee is going to steal from an employer, you can give them MMPI, Millen, multi-axials, Rorschachs, whatever. But the best predictor is a good history. Mm-hmm. Go talk to their last three employers, and if you can find out where they stole from them or not, that's going to give you the best idea where they're going to steal from you or not. Mm-hmm. So you committed fraud, so you would say, okay, the best predictor is that you would commit fraud again, unless there's been some substantial intervening variable. So you committed fraud, but then you got caught, humiliated, held accountable. So the chance that you're likely to reoffend is probably much less than the next 100 guys that haven't offended and paid the price for it. You're probably the best bet on Wall Street, having been burned.
There's no question. I've been introduced on many stages in front of thousands of people, and the person introducing me has said the same thing. I've been to sentencing with clients where the U.S. attorney says, Your Honor, the likelihood of this defendant reoffending is practically none. However, for the deterrence factor, we ask for 24 months of incarceration. You are absolutely right. None of our clients at White Collar Advice have reoffended.
I'm asking you, can you get back to you? Can you get back to the you that your partner fell in love with? Have you lost yourself? Have you gotten so caught up in being a husband or wife, a boyfriend or girlfriend, a partner, half of a couple, that you lost all of who you are? Because if you can't be 100% of who you are and be half of a couple at the same time, something's gone wrong. You should be able to be an individual and still be half of a couple. If you lose your individuality, the price is too high. The relationship is dysfunctional. You've got to reclaim who you are, and that's who your partner fell in love with. And you can say, well, I got that beat out of me. My partner took that away from me. Well, no, they didn't. I'll get to that in a minute. But they didn't fall in love with who you are now. They fell in love with who you were then. So don't we need to get back to that? Robin and I've joked sometimes. She'll say, you know, I wish you were more sensitive, or I wish you were more emotional. And I said, well, you married a linebacker. Doesn't mean I can't work to be those things, but you kind of knew who I was when you married me. I was pretty cerebral and had a pretty violent job at the time. I mean, that's who I was and what I did. I mean, I was a jock. I was a jock then. I'm a jock now. I mean, it's 48 years later, and I do sports every day, 7 days a week. I did them then. I do them now. It's who I am. And she has been so supportive in me being who I am. She really has not tried to change me into being who she might at different times think she wishes I was. Now, look, that doesn't mean you can't modify yourself. You can't grow. You can't evolve. Certainly you can. My God, we've been married 43 years. That has not been 1 year 43 times over. We've been married a second year, a third year, a fourth year, a fifth year, and the fifth year wasn't like the first year, and the 10th year wasn't like the fifth year. We have evolved. You don't ever want to have 1 year's experience 43 times. You want each year to build on the one before, so of course you evolve, but you never lose your roots. You never lose your identity. And when I say get back to you, I want you to make a commitment to yourself that you're going to live with integrity, honesty, compassion, and you're going to do it in a way that you generate enthusiasm, that you're your own best friend. Now, your partner's going to be your best friend as well, but you've got to be a good friend to yourself. You know, I always tell people, you're the easiest person to tell yourself no. You're the easiest person to say no to. You know, you can make a dentist appointment. You can make an appointment to meet somebody for lunch. You can make an appointment to see a therapist. You can make an appointment to do 10 different things. And when it comes time to have me time, you've got 5 things to do that day. Time runs short. Who's the easiest person to cancel on? You. You're the easiest person to cancel on, right? It's easier to cancel on yourself than it is to call the dentist and say, I'm not coming. It's easier to tell yourself, well, I'll just do this tomorrow, instead of calling your therapist and say, I'm not coming, or calling your mother and say, oh, I'm not going to come over and see you. It's easier to tell yourself no. It shouldn't be, but it is. Because then you avoid confrontation. And what I'm saying is, if you're your own best friend, then you won't cancel on you. You wouldn't cancel lunch with your best friend if they were counting on it. And if you're your own best friend, then you wouldn't cancel on you. You wouldn't cancel things that are important to you. You wouldn't settle for less. You wouldn't settle for living with less than integrity and honesty and compassion and enthusiasm. So we talked about the bad spirit. I want to talk about the good spirit. I want to talk about the things that you can do to make your relationship better. And the first one is to own your relationship. Own your relationship. You are not a victim. You can say, well, I'm married to a jerk. I'm in a relationship with somebody that's just impossible. I'm a victim here. Dr. Phil, you don't know this person. They're impossible. They're the most miserable human being on the face of the earth. This is ground zero for miserable. I'm married to the worst person in the world. They find something wrong with everything. Well, okay, that's your victim story. But you've got to own that relationship. You created this relationship. You picked this person. And whatever is going on in this relationship, you either elicited it, maintain it, or allow it. You're not a victim. You either elicit, maintain, or allow what's going on in your relationship. You are the architect of your thoughts, your thought patterns, your behaviors. Whatever your partner's bad habits are, you need to ask yourself, what do you do to pay them off for that? If they are constantly late, if you're going somewhere, you're meeting someone for dinner, or you have a reservation somewhere, and they are chronically late. I mean, it's a fight every time. You make a reservation somewhere, you're going to be there at 7:30, and 7:30, you're ready to go, and they're not, and you leave at 8:15 every time. And so you are mad every time. You are arguing every time. You need to ask yourself what you're doing to elicit, maintain, or allow that behavior, because you are not a victim. You are doing something to enable that behavior. You are paying them off for that behavior. So instead of asking yourself, what is wrong with them that they do this, you need to ask yourself, what am I doing to reinforce this behavior on their part? Look at your role. Now, you may say, look, why are you blaming this on me? I'm not the one that's late. I'm not blaming it on you. I'm saying you're the only one you have control over. You're the only one that you have input to. You need to own your relationship. Take off the victim hat, put it on the shelf, and become an owner of your relationship. If your partner is just unplugged, what are you doing that elicits, maintains, or allows that? How are you paying them off for being unplugged? Are you allowing them to be lazy? Are you failing to engage? Have you given up? What are you doing to enable that behavior? Enable means I make it easier for them to do something by my conduct. Own your relationship. You're not a victim. What are you doing to elicit that behavior? What are you doing to maintain it? What are you doing to allow it? Take control. Confront the situation. Own your relationship. Quit blaming your partner for it and own it. If you're so smart, if you're so right, then why can't you fix it? You can. You can fix it by owning it. What's the second thing you can do? You can accept the risk of being vulnerable. Now, this is really important. If your relationship is not working exactly the way you want it to, then you've gone into protective mode. You put your dukes up. You got your fist out in front of you. You're ready to fight because you don't trust your partner. They've hurt you. And so you start playing the what-if game. Well, I'm not going to expose myself. I'm going to let myself feel again, love again, be exposed again. Because what if they betray me again? What if they lie to me again? What if they cheat on me again? What if they get cold on me again? What if I do what you're saying, Dr. Phil? What if I become vulnerable again? What if I put it on the line again and they let me down again? Look, I really don't mind you playing the what-if game in a relationship. I really don't. As long as you play it out to the end. If you're going to ask the question, what if? What if they betray me? What if they lie to me? What if they let me down? Okay, I don't mind you playing that game as long as you answer the question. If you say, what if they let me down? Then answer the damn question. What if they do? Are you going to explode? Are there going to be hair, teeth, and eyes all over the wall? Are you just going to explode because they lied to you again? Well, no. Of course you're not. You didn't last time. Did it hurt? Yes. Were you upset? Yes. Are you still here? Yes. Did you die? No. I've told you before, two things. Number one, never invest more than you can afford to lose. I hear these things. People say, it just devastated me. It just killed me. No, it didn't. It didn't devastate you. It didn't kill you. It just broke my heart. No, it didn't. It hurt you. But it didn't kill you. You know how I know it didn't kill you? Because you're still listening to me. You're not dead. You're still here. The other thing I've told you is that language is very powerful. If you use words like horrible, devastated, killed, those come with a lot of power. You say, it was just horrible. You know, she lied to me. She cheated me. It just destroyed me. It just devastated me. Well, no, it didn't. Your kidneys are still working. Your heart's still beating. You're upset. It hurts your feelings. And 2 years from now, you'll be with somebody and you'll look back and say, oh my God, if she hadn't cheated on me, I'd have never met this person who I am head over heels in love with. It's funny how things work. If the person hadn't cheated on me and left me, then I'd have never met this person that I love more than life itself. So that was actually a blessing. I'm so glad that happened because now I've met this person. Does it hurt? Yes. Is it okay? No, it's not okay. I'm not trying to trivialize it. Nothing matters. Yes, it matters. Of course it matters. Does it have gravity? Yes, it has gravity. But it's bad enough without you catastrophizing it with your language. Accept the risk of vulnerability. If you say, what if I say, okay, I'm going to get emotionally invested again. I'm going to approach them again. I'm going to show affection again. I'm going to engage again. What if they just turn a cold shoulder to me again? Well, okay, what if they do? Then you'll try something else. Or maybe you'll eventually have enough and say, that's it, I'm out of here. I'm not going to spend the rest of my life beating my head against the wall. But you will survive. Accept the risk of vulnerability and accept the fact that you will survive. The third thing you've got to do is accept your partner. And that means you've got to stop focusing on the negatives. You got to take the chip off your shoulder. You have to realize that you don't have to react to everything you can react to. Just because they do something that you can justify being upset about, you can justify being hurt about, you can justify being wounded by, doesn't mean you have to be. You know, you can make a joke out of it. You can choose to tease them about it. Pain is the price that you pay for resisting the natural order of things. There is a natural order of things. There's just a certain way people are going to be. Like I've said, Robin's very emotional. I love that about her. She's so much fun in that regard, and she gets so excited about things. It just fills up the room, and it's great when our kids were growing up, and it's great now with our grown kids and our grandkids. She gets so excited about things, and it just brings a texture to life that's really, really nice. I'm much more cerebral. I just kind of think about things, and I might have a great sense of satisfaction inside, but I don't do the happy dance like Snoopy in the Peanuts cartoons. She'll sometimes turn around and say, give me something. Come on. I mean, it's like you won the lottery or something. Give me something. Jump up and down. Throw caution to the wind and break into a smile. She teases me about it. But she doesn't resist the natural order of things because she knows that that's just the way I am. I'm kind of reserved in that way. I was raised by an alcoholic father in a very combative situation, and I kind of have emotions that are a little more constricted. That's just the natural order of things. So she knows that, and she'll redo something in the house and say, okay, come in and look at this. All right, close your eyes. Now open your eyes. What do you think? And I'll look at it and say, oh, yeah, I think I might like this. It's like, oh, God, do you like it or do you not? Well, after about 10 years, she's learned it'll take about a week for him to kind of think about it and look at it and live with it a while. And he'll sit in the room a while and look around and stuff. And then, you know, in about a week, he'll tell me, I really like this. This really feels good. I really like this. And when he says it, he'll really mean it. But he's not going to just jump up and down and go, oh, wow, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my whole life. That's just not the natural order of things for me. And she's been great about accepting that. So ask yourself, do you accept your partner and their natural way of being in the world? And, you know, you don't have to love everything about somebody to love them. You can love what they do in certain situations and not love what they do in others, but you can still love them. I love that she gets so excited about things. And if by my yardstick it would be too excited, that's just by my yardstick. It's not by hers. So I accept her and her emotionality, and she accepts me and my analytical approach. And between us, it's a pretty good balance. So ask yourself, what can I do to accept my partner and the natural order of things the way they naturally are, instead of criticizing the fact that they aren't the way you are? Because like I said, Robin's very different from me. I don't want her to be just like me. I did not want our kids to grow up with two me's. I wanted them to grow up with a Robin and a Phil. And I certainly didn't want to be married to me. I don't want to be married to somebody that looks at things the way I look at them, thinks about things the way I look at them, reacts to things the way I react to them. How boring would that be if you were married to somebody that thought, felt, acted, reacted exactly the way you do? God, how boring would that be? That'd be terrible. You don't want that. You want them to be different. So accept your partner. Find things about them that you can focus on that are positive.